Thanks for joining us for our very exciting first birthday with Collaborative Social Change. We're delighted to be joined today by Patrick Gregoire and Veronica Mosqueda of Cancer Rent DC, which is a there we are, a coalition of community organisations based in DC, working to protect long time and predominantly Black and Brown residents of the district from eviction and displacement, the risks of which have obviously starkly increased as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. We're really excited to have them come and talk to us, I think, to kind of share some of their insights about organizing, and I think in a way that, as we'll see, matches up quite well with what we do and hope to do at CSC. And just a quick reminder as well that we're also trying to raise some money for Cancer Rent DC. So I'm gonna stick a link to the fundraiser in the chat, and I'll email that out to everyone as well. If anyone feels generous and feels like opening their purses, it'd be much appreciated, I'm sure. Before properly introducing and handing over to Patrick and Veronica, I think it's worth just saying a quick thank you to the rest of the CSC founding members team, who've all been kind of working behind and in front of the scenes to make this work. So we've got Zach Barghouti over here, who's named Collaborative Social Change in the corner there, our kind of tech maestro and Zoom gatekeeper handling our stream up to YouTube. We've got Nusha Imatzadeh, and I think Shireen Mege is potentially joining soon, who'll be helping to kind of monitor the chat for some questions to go to the panel at the end. And Yatana Yamahato is here at a truly ungodly hour of the night in Japan as well. So a special thank you there, who's going to be watching and listening, and we'll then be kind of writing up a summary of the event to go on our blog later on. Thank you everyone, and thank you everyone else kind of who's been a part of CSC, who's helped us get to where we are so far. Here's to many more years. So to kick things off with a quick introduction to kind of CSC's mandate and to how Cancer Rent DC ties in closely with it. We've got our founder, Dr. Sahar Bajandian, who, as well as founding CSC, is a fantastic critical scholar of transitional justice and a practitioner with years of experience working across, you know, several important causes around the world. Worked for years with the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission as a statement gatherer, and subsequently as a consultant to this day. Then went to Uganda, where she worked for years, founded an organization, worked with several others while researching for her PhD, and can now be found conducting a postdoc at Binghamton in New York State. And anyone with any degree of familiarity will know that this is a kind of bordering on uncharitably cursory overview of everything that Zahara has done. I mean, quite how she does find the time to do it all, I think, is a mystery to all of us, but we're all very pleased that she does. So without further ado, over to you.
Thank you, Danny. I didn't expect that nice of an introduction. I'm kind of red now. Thank you very much. Huge thank you to Danny. I mean, he's like our anchor through this whole thing. And I'm grateful to all the founding members, all the people on the call, our guests, Veronica, and also a member of our network as well, Patrick, for sharing their lessons learned with us today. I wanted to just quickly tell you that it's very humbling and exciting to be here. I think all of us are trying to juggle full-time work, full-time school, a bunch of different jobs, some of us, but we're chipping away at the dream, and it's making me more and more excited about what the future holds. And although it's slow in progress, we know it's a long game, and to have all of you on this call on a Saturday is a testament to really what it's been like for all of us all, you know, throughout the last year, and if not the year leading up to the soft launch last year as well, for Collaborative Social Change to become a reality. So I'm just so grateful. And I won't get teary-eyed, but I feel like it. I'm getting there. And it's not the pregnancy hormones. I think I would just actually be teary-eyed right now with all that we've done, and where we are now. I'm joining you guys from upstate New York. It's Binghamton specifically. It's the ancestral and traditional territories of the Haudenosaunee peoples, and that's the people of the Longhouse. And as a relative newcomer, I'm learning more and more about the specific nations that whose traditional lands I'm on, which is the Onondaga and Oneida nations. And I'm really grateful to call this home. I continue my learning journey, as I hope a lot of you in different settler colonies are also doing. I wanted to kind of just talk a little bit about what collaborative social change is. We have some folks that are going to hopefully see this that are new to CSC and maybe see something or a link that inspires them to join us, because we would love to expand our network and continue to grow. Collaborative social change, at the in a nutshell, is a transnational network of very, very different scholars and practitioners and change makers, activists, community organizers working at different levels, different skill sets, anything from marketing and web design to policy development and international law to architecture and engineering backgrounds, trying to figure out how we can be a lot more efficient at addressing and preventing direct structural and cultural violence. And we're inspired by Johann Galtung's theory of violence, which is really, I see Patrick. Yeah, Johann Galtung's the man. but his general theory of violence is any avoidable act that causes mental or physical harm. And direct violence is very visible, right? You see that mental or physical harm, and you can trace that back to a subject causing that harm, an individual or a group causing that harm. But structural violence is a lot more hidden, and it's a lot more a systemic issue. So it's the way our systems that govern our lives behave. And you know that that effect, that mental and physical harm is occurring. But it's very difficult to kind of link the effects of systemic issues and harms to specific individuals and groups. And so what needs to happen to eradicate structural violence is far beyond just holding one or two or a group of people accountable. We have to change our institutional logics, the cultures that are embedded in these institutions, the mentality of the people operationalizing these institutions, the laws that govern them. There's so many different layers of change that have to happen for us to transform how these systems function. So it's multi-layered, multifaceted, and very hidden. But we see a turn and a lot more attention towards structural violence, primarily because affected groups are the ones calling for us to do this, not because any top-down approach is saying, hey, we should probably take a look at this, but more so affected communities saying, we see you, we trace you, we'll name you, we'll show you. and it's brilliant to watch and see, and gives me hope. And then cultural violence is really about those norms, the indicators in everyday life that tell us what's good and bad, what's acceptable, unacceptable. And it's through our entertainment, our different moral sources, be it cultural or religious institutions or our families, propaganda, our education, all those different sites in our everyday lives that kind of show us what's acceptable and not, social mores, social norms. That normalize the other kinds of violence, that tell us it's okay or it's acceptable to see that direct or structural violence and kind of make us numb to it. So it's an underappreciated area of violence, I think, and one that we really need to pay a lot more attention to if we want to prevent the other kinds of harm. But we're just really just starting to kind of get there. And I think one good example is really seeing that shift in pronouns that we're seeing coming from the LGBTQI community, just drawing attention to our linguistics and how we use language to communicate binaries, for example, in terms of what gender can be. And as you kind of confront that in your everyday, you might pause and think, oh, wow, like I just assume I'm talking to a straight male or straight female, or I assumed a lot. And those little shifts in culture is really an effective way kind of to draw attention to cultural violence. But again, we have a long way to go. I think we have a long way to go to really do well at addressing cultural violence. And so the theory of change for us as a network is that if we were to concentrate a lot more on addressing and preventing direct structural and cultural violence in the everyday, then we'll be much more effective at preventing atrocity violence like genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, kind of that large scale human rights violations and large scale violations of inherent indigenous rights. The point is to kind of be morally shocked by the everyday violence before we get to kind of the atrocity violence that we're all, you know, shocked by on our televisions or we can't believe we're hearing about. And, you know, how we do this work as a network is that we try to mobilize as many skill sets as possible and break the barriers of the skill sets we typically associate with this kind of atrocity violence work, which is policy and law and maybe academia, but really move away from that and start to think about how does every sector contribute? How does every skill set contribute? And how do you expand that network and continue to do so, so that everyone understands they have a responsibility and a role to preventing this kind of harm? And we're problem driven as well. So we don't have predetermined programs. We wait for either a member of our network or a member outside of our network to kind of bring an issue to the table. And we figure out, can we mobilize skill sets around that problem and either support a member of a network in their local community, if we can, as a transnational network. But if not, then maybe there's a transnational initiative in it that we can launch together. To address an issue that's, you know, cross-cultural and cuts across borders. So with that in mind, be it our mandate and kind of how we do our work, I'm absolutely elated to hear from Cancel Rent DC, particularly Patrick and Veronica that are joining us. Veronica is our guest, I hope a longtime partner and hopefully a member someday as well of CSC. And Patrick is a member of CSC's network. He's a longtime friend of mine and we met actually at NYU, and I'm excited to hear about, you know, his work as well as learn from it. They're actually working to address structural, cultural, and economic violence in Washington, D.C., and they're doing it in a very collaborative way where they're actually working with the true experts, which are the community members who are longstanding BIPOC Washingtonians that are being displaced from their homes, forcibly displaced from their homes. And I won't get too much into how they're doing that because that's what they're going to share with us. But as you can see, they're responding with that urgency to the everyday forms of violence that we would hope to see kind of, you know, ripple through all of our communities and society. So with that said, I just kind of want to hold space and turn it back over to Danny. Thank you all so much. I'm so excited for decades of work to come and to see where we go. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, kind of wonderful overview that I think hopefully gives that kind of nice, rich, apart from anything else, theoretical context into which, you know, Patrick and Veronica are going to bring some very, very grounded and concrete advice and just like an example of exactly what it looks like to kind of address structural violence in the everyday, you know, kind of what does that violence actually look like? Who are the people we need to listen to define it? What do we need to do? But yeah, without wanting to preempt too much of that, by way of introduction, yeah, Patrick and Veronica are co-founders of Cancel Rent DC, which, you know, that they'll be able to explain better than I would the organization itself. But, you know, Veronica is an immigrant abolitionist, a formidable and dedicated community organizer with over a decade's experience fighting for migrant and housing justice in DC and elsewhere, and worked tirelessly to kind of empower tenants and build active networks of solidarity across racial, linguistic, generational lines. As in part of several different campaigns, as I say, to do with housing justice, migrant justice, but also to do with shutting down immigration centers in Texas. And as a keystone member of the Cancel Rent Coalition, it's kind of really well placed to give us that kind of really valuable insight into, you know, what does it look like? What does effective organizing look like? What does support for our local communities look like? How do we kind of put this stuff into practice? And we're, of course, no less blessed to be joined by Patrick Gregoire, who, as well as holding the illustrious title of consultant at Collaborative Social Change, is an equally experienced community organizer, similarly focused on fighting for and crucially with marginalized communities in DC and against gentrification and displacement. Patrick heads the Right to Housing Community for Right to Housing Committee, for One DC, which is one of the organisations that makes up the Council Rent Coalition, where he works to recruit working class people of colour to organise, educate, and fight for their human right to housing. And we've asked Patrick and Veronica to kind of speak to three main points. I think one, to kind of cover their general approach to the work with council rent and, you know, why is it that they do things the way they do? And second, to give isn't that very valuable insight into the kind of nitty-gritty day-to-day work of organising the kind of, what does that look like, you know, outside of the kind of big overtures towards activism and listening and sport and whatever, what does that look like on a day-to-day basis? And then third, to offer some kind of general recommendations and for allyship and support for people outside of the community or, you know, for other organisations within their own communities. And after that, hopefully, we'll have a bit of time to then turn to some questions to all of you guys. And to which, you know, if you have questions you'd like to ask, just stick that in the general chat box. And Nusha will very kindly pick through them and pick the right ones to field to you guys. So yeah, without further ado, I will close my mouth so you can open yours.
You want to go first? Should I go first? Or?
Okay.
Danny, thank you so much for the intro. Sarah, thank you as well. If you could accompany us wherever we go and introduce us, I think we'd all be better for it. Yeah, I think, you know, we could just dive right into this. Tackling the first point would be like our approach to our work and why we approach it in the ways we do. And I'm going to pass it over to Veronica, who's going to talk to us a little bit about like what is the overall structure of Council Rent DC and its membership and why it is that way. And I'm just hand it over to her.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much. Happy to be here. I'm Veronica. So let me actually start with a little bit of context, right? Hopefully you've had a chance to read a little bit about us, but the Council Rent DC Coalition is a group of about 12 organizations and individual members that came together during the pandemic. At the time, it really was us coming united to prevent mass eviction and displacement of longtime residents from the district, especially Black and Brown residents. And really, this was as a result of the COVID, of the pandemic. For the last 2 years, we have really had this like shorter term goal to secure legislation and budget to ensure that no resident of the district
short term goal will be secure legislation.
That anyone will, we just wanted to make sure that, you know, pass legislations to ensure that no resident would be evicted or put into debt because of the COVID crisis. Longer term, we really share this long-term values and a commitment to really shift away from a capitalist housing system to one that promotes racial and economic equity for DC's Black and Brown residents. So as Patrick said, I can share a little bit about what our structure really looks like. You know, our coalition really spent months and we came together May of 2020, really early into the pandemic. And we spent months, despite us being in this like state of extreme emergency, because pre-pandemic, we were already in a housing crisis, but we knew we really needed to root to build a really solid foundation. So we spent the first few months really building an internal infrastructure, our mission, our values, and really beyond that, really just like community, like agreements and how we would show up with each other. And also really focus on how we were going to move forward with our decision-making, knowing that all of these things are really fluid. These are just living, breathing like processes that we have to have in order to, you know, live our values, you know, not replicate the same systems of oppression within our own movements. And then after that, we really started moving forward with the work. So when we created our structure, we really decided to focus on four efforts that are completely interlinked, right? And we created four working groups, meaning we had an action working group, we have an action working group, a policy working group, a communications working group. And of course, I'm gonna forget the fourth one, right? In our outreach working group. It's like, I'm always going to forget the fourth, right? And you know, each one working in tandem with each other, collaborating, but really these being very separate meetings and weekly get-togethers where people, where you know, community members and folks from organizations are working on our messaging or our legislation or the actions, right? How we were going to mobilize and really put pressure, what we would call like our outside game in a movement. And also outreach, right? Because in order to really be able to do this work, we really have to engage with community members. We really need to make sure that we are on the ground. Part of our structure also includes bi-weekly Monday meetings where we really come as a coalition to share updates, to really talk some next steps, and just have like some fluidity in the way that we come together. We also spend about twice a year in longer periods of time, like really in retreats where we start talking about our strategic planning, assessing and really addressing like anything that we have spent the last 6 months, or a little bit more working on and assessing whether like what we're doing is working and really focusing on our power analysis, really reassessing the landscape. As I'm sure you all know, things have continue to this day to change pretty quickly. And we really need to one, adapt and respond to that, but also know that like we need to build, as we are working to build our movement, we are looking at something longer term, and we need to also like be able to like drive some of that narrative. And I believe, and the last thing I'm missing as part of like our structure, we also have these like monthly community meetings where we are really like focusing on like political analysis development, political education, skills building with impacted community members. I mentioned that we are made up of 12 organizations, give or take, right? Things are pretty fluid. Each organization is really different. Some are membership-based orgs. Some are orgs that are offer legal support. Some are housing organizing organizations like the one I was a part of. And now I'm actually just an individual member. So really our coalition is pretty, diverse, and it's on purpose, right? Like we need to have different types of folks who are in the space who can leverage different resources, skills, expertise, while at the same time centering like the most impacted. I will stop there and I will kick it on to Patrick so he can share a little bit about just some of our strategic choices and how we frame our work. And, you know, even just, I think sometimes organizing and activism gets conflated. So we're just gonna do a little bit of demystifying around that.
Thank you, Veronica. Demystifying, that's the word. See, I wouldn't have done that. Before I start, I should also preface that I am no longer with 1DC, I'm with Amnesty International, but that's for some other portion of this meeting. We are primarily community organizers, and I will take a couple minutes to talk a little bit about the differences between community organizing, advocacy, and activism. And Veronica, if I forget anything wrong, please jump in. I think one of the principal differences, I think like the biggest difference between those three is, whereas activism and advocacy can include the community, community organizing has to be collective in its nature. It has to not only involve the community, the kind of community organizing we want to do is led by the community, right? It's not enough to center the voices and experiences of those most impacted. You got to center that leadership. You got to develop that leadership, right? You got to support the development of that leadership, right? And you got to do it in a way that does not recreate past harmful structures, right? Whereas things like activism can be done, activism can look like mobilizing a whole bunch of people to come to a protest, and it can look like, clicking, doing some clicks on your own chair, right? It can be a very individual act, usually with the goal to spread awareness, right? And I think one of the biggest differences too with community organizing, a big part of community organizing is building up skills of the folks that you're trying to build power with, because that's what building power means, right? It means building up your capacity to influence your environment, right? So that's what we're trying to do with our folks. We're trying to build up their capacity to be not only be their own advocates, but to also recognize who has the power to concede to their demands, and then recognizing what it is that, you know, they need to do in order to get those folks to concede, right? Whereas, for example, like advocacy is something that's usually done by a professional class of folks, right? People that went through more traditional routes of education. And as we know, the way in which the systems in which we live, you know, a lot of people are going to be denied that paths for no other reasons besides just structural inequities, right? And also, advocacy operates within the pre-established frames of those that you're trying to get concessions from, right? A clear example of this would be at the beginning of our journey with our legislative campaign, we went to our city council and, you know, we're like, yo, we came up with this like legislation, we bandied up with some lawyers, and look, it's even constitutional, you know, this, that, and the third. Left and right, counselors were telling us, this isn't constitutional, this isn't constitutional. They weren't reading any of this, right? And then the more savvy ones would go, okay, so what do you want us to do about this? How about this? How about that? How about, you know, basically trying to get us to do their job and trying to take us into this labyrinthine process, right? And had we like taken the bait, one, even if that path would have led to anywhere, it would have taken years. And it would have been death by a thousand cuts, right? Like, we're gonna have to get rid of this thing. We're gonna have to get rid of this thing. So the kind of change that we were looking for, though absolutely we need the support and help of professional advocates, the kind of change that we needed to see was kind of outside of those bounds. So I hope that clarifies a little bit on the differences between what we mean between like advocacy, activism, and then community organizing. And you know, we'll have questions at the end for sure on that. But you know, if that is clear, then maybe I'm thinking we could get into the nitty-gritty of this work. You know, this work is full of jargony terms and you know, to use some of Veronica's language, it's quite mystifying. So hopefully we can really just take the abstract, make it concrete. And to start us off, I think Veronica is going to talk to us a little bit about what range of issues do we tackle as a coalition. And then we're going to get into like examples of everyday work. So with that, I'm passing it back to you, V.
Thanks. I think one last thing I would add around organizing is that, and you know, thank you so much, Patrick, for that, is right, it's building solidarity with and amongst impacted communities, with groups, and that is absolutely like necessary to the work. It is something that we are all doing together, building power with each other. And, you know, as we build power among like impacted communities, that can also develop like that capacity to take on further problems that are the will and the power of the people. But yeah, thanks so much. Also, of course, looking at many, many tabs just to make sure I'm looking at our agenda. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, like really the primary issue that we have really taken on as a coalition for the last 2 years has been really passing this life-saving legislation. You know, it has several demands of how we envision this, what cancel rent means, right? I mean, you hear cancel rent and I think a lot of people are like, wait, what does that mean? And we have an actual set of demands of what that means, right, for folks. I'm happy to go through those, although I know that there was a share a little bit about who we are, but you know, we really wanted to make sure folks would not be evicted or have no debt due to the pandemic. We wanted to make sure all tenants would be able to certify to a COVID hardship. We wanted folks to, if there was going to be rent relief, as there was, we wanted that burden of application to really fall on the landlords, as a lot of these processes are so like hard and inaccessible. And we also, know that landlords also have to certify this process. So we were like, why include tenants in this process when landlords can just, but you know, take care of that. We also wanted to have funds for landlords that, so they would have access to the funds needed to cover rent. So, you know, our legislation was is pretty comprehensive. And that is what we have spent really at this point, the last 2 years focusing on. Within that main focus, right, we have spent time having several actions trying to mobilize folks and build power. We have also spent time really like trying to do a lot of community building, but also at the same time, a lot of the folks who are in this space are right impacted tenants who are having to survive, who got sick, who were unable to work, or who had to take care of other folks. So there was also a mutual aid, there's a mutual aid aspect to the work that is very ad hoc, or again, like each member, you know, each organizational member, again, looks very different. So on top of the cancel rent that we are doing, each org is also doing some other work, whether it's, you know, like me working on tenant related issues and still working on supporting tenants through housing conditions and rent strikes, and landlords doing many, many, many unethical things to try to displace tenants, and other, you know, organizations are more of on the labor side and work with workers who were, you know, who a lot of them weren't able to work, you know, restaurant workers when the who couldn't work during a big part of the shutdown. So again, like, we came together with this focus around the legislation, but at the same time, we were moving forward with also making sure that people's like needs were being met. So we focused a lot also on mutual aid, and really, and at the same time, in the last, I would say, year, as some of the rental relief programs that truly are wholly like insufficient started, you know, coming out, also pushing back on what these rental relief programs look like. There were some tenants who really got involved and some roundtables with council members, like DC council members, around pushing for this rent up for the rental relief program to be more accessible to tenants, for us to have more funds. So there was that part of our work. And I know I wanted to say something else that we have been focusing on. And there's also the eviction prevention part, right? Even though like we had a stay on evictions, we know that a lot of landlords are still, you know, still move forward. We're really trying to displace tenants in a myriad of ways, and really illegal ways, but also just, I mean, they're all illegal and unethical, but in ways that to them are loopholes, you know, like displacement through neglect. So we were also focusing also on tenant organizing and just eviction prevention, and also know your rights, because the legislation, emergency legislation, and also just regular legislation can be, again, inaccessible. I think there's a lot of misinformation out there on purpose. So just also really making sure that people knew and understood their rights, that they could pass that on to their community members. And that is something that we were consistently on top of, because in DC, our emergency legislation would change like every couple of months. So then we would just like have to look through the entire legislation and be like, okay, these are the changes, these are the shifts, you know? So, yeah, that is some of the work that we have done for the last 2 years. And as of now, the coalition recently, our latest retreat, actually decided to pivot away from our legislation, unfortunately. But I think that due to the changes to the public health emergency, federal and local rent relief dollars, and really just like COVID fatigue, we just have decided to move away from our legislative campaign and have decided to, we are in this process of figuring out how to move forward, because we have this strong sense that everything that we have worked toward in this infrastructure that exists needs to continue. So we are in that process of like figuring out how do we integrate with the larger housing landscape, and what is it that we need to focus on specifically? And maybe our, and I think this is a really just good point to make, that we are a coalition, we are not a campaign. You know, it's truly heartbreaking to have to pivot away from something that is truly crucial and life-saving. And we know that we have this ready to go for maybe the future. I'm hoping that we can still push some form of our legislation in the future, but that is not all that this work is. I know I could go on forever, so I will kick it to Patrick to also share a little bit about some of our everyday work, what that looks like, and fill in anything that you think I missed.
Thank you, Veronica. A couple things I want to say before I jump into that is, one, I definitely do want to uplift the victories that we've had. Part of the reason why I'm pivoting away from our legislation is because the State DC program has seen a measure of success. And if it has done so, it's because of coalitions like Cancel Rent DC and other partners that really just hammered it at our local officials. You know, the first iteration of State DC had all types of problems. All types of people at risk were unable to participate. So a lot, you know, we have had some victories here that have made this all worth it and continues to make it worth it. Another thing I want to bring in is also just to try to couch this in its historical context for those of you that might not be familiar. You know, like, oh, housing justice. Yeah, that sounds, you know, like that necessary and cool. Housing justice, particularly in DC, but in all metropolitan areas in the States, is one of the oldest forms of racial and economic oppression, right? In DC, there's really no limit to how much you can talk about the harm that has been done to Black folks and as an extension, the way Brown folks and Asian folks have been treated in DC. Going back to Black Georgetown, no one knows that Georgetown used to be a Black enclave. Southwest DC with urban renewal. If you talk about conditions back in the 60s in Southwest DC, you're talking about stuff that you'd be reading in like Idi Amin's Uganda. It really just, you don't gotta go look far to see these more exotic atrocities. Berry Farms, which was hard won for Black freedmen that fought in the war, was half of it was taken away back in the early 40s for World War II to develop weapons of mass destruction research. And then the rest of it was taken away a couple years ago to make more luxury condos and whatnot. Redlining and race covenants. Up until the 60s or 70s, it was law in certain neighborhoods. The Bloomingdale neighborhood, 10 minutes away, do not rent to Negroes. Do not rent to Negroes or Jews. And when that was no longer law, it was just culture, as Sarah was talking about, right? This still happens to this day in DC. And, you know, urban planning as a topic of social justice can seem a little mundane to those that looking from the outside in, but urban planning has been one of the primary and continues to be one of the primary ways in which our overlords, honestly, manifest this oppression. You know, DC is a highly segregated city. Most Black folks live in Southeast, Ward 7 and 8. That was legally mandated, and then it was culturally enforced, divested, like this is still the case. Any of y'all that live in metropolitan, major metropolitan areas, I, you know, challenge you to do a little research on neighborhoods, and it's the same story again and again and again and again and again. Major companies like is it BlackRock or Blackstone own like half of the world. But so this really is just like one of the oldest racial and economic justice fights out there. So just wanted to like put that context there before we get to the what this everyday work look like. You know, I can speak a little bit about my experience. Veronica's experience is similar but different in its own way. During my time at 1DC, so I participated, in the general meetings, but where I put most of my energy where it was in the action working group and in the outreach working group. And so what I would be doing with 1DC on our Right to Housing Committee, one was, you know, we always needed to find, you have to find the membership, you got to cultivate the membership, you got to sustain the membership. That means finding people where they're at. It means a lot of phone banking, cold calling, means door knocking, street canvassing, meeting people where they are. You know, if that means like you're having your super duper important discussion at Wanda's on 7th, which is the hair salon. Very noisy place to have a meeting, but you're just yelling across, talking about council rent stuff. Or you going driving like an hour away to be in folks' neighborhoods. For council rent, we had this, we did these visual projects during the pandemic, right? Capturing stories of folks. At first they were like bigger pieces, but then they were like smaller snippets. But in one of them, I'm talking to one of our members, and then bah, 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 literally boys shooting guns, literally just 10 feet below us. And we're like, so this is why we need to cancel rent. But in the action group, that is where we, you know, this is where we devised like our tactic. It was like, you know, the war room, right? So for a long time, our target was Anita Bonds, the chair of the housing committee for DC. And essentially, you know, it was finding out like what her maxim is. What is the thing that she needs in order to keep business as usual? What is it? How can we keep it from her so that she comes to the table? I don't know that we ever really found out like all the way, because that kind of research, you know, you ain't gonna find this stuff on the internet, right? You gotta have people in her office. You gotta do a little spycraft. One of our bolder actions that unfortunately we didn't get to see all the way through, but we were targeting Fort Myers Construction, which is a construction company that's a huge political player in DC. Anita Bonds used to be the corporate liaison to Fort Myers, and also it was her biggest donor. We had this big action that we were going to do against Fort Myers Construction, where we were going to block off their roadways and whatnot in order to ensure that they can't do their job. So Mr. Rodriguez starts losing money, and then he starts going, "What the hell is going on?" And the whole messaging was like, "Hey, sorry, my man. I know you're trying to do shit. We looking for your best friend in your bonds. We can't seem to get a hold of her. Could you tell us where she's at?" And it was really funny because in order to pull off these kinds of actions, you got to do a lot of, you know, quite a bit of research. And some of it is desk research, but other research was, we had members, one of our former paid staff and I, we pretended to be like urban photographers, and we were walking around dig sites and whatnot. And we're just like, "Oh, we're just doing this thing for like a video or whatever." And we're like, "All right, here's a good place to like, maybe like bring people here, blah, blah, blah." We had another member who, I mean, he's a real one. In torrential downpour, he went on one of the sites pretending to look for a job, you know, leveraged his identities. And he was like, "Hey, I'm looking for a job," taking notes of like exits and whatnot. So that's what some of the action work looked like. And then just like logistics, planning actions and whatnot. Outreach, you know, we had our traditional ways of doing outreach based building, but then we had folks come up with ways of like, you know, for example, doing caravans, having just a caravan of cars going through neighborhoods, blasting music, handing out food, whatever. "Hey, do you got a minute to talk? X, Y, Z." Food and music, always a great way to get folks to come together. Working off our power map, right? Which is like our main analytics, right? Figuring out who are the power players and, you know, where do they, like, who's a potential ally, who can be moved, right? And hopefully this is like an iterative process. We had the policy group, which was incredibly important. I didn't have quite the constitution for it, but maybe Veronica, you can talk a little bit about your day-to-day with Cancel Rent.
Sure, yeah. I was part of the, or am a part of the policy working group. So I'm not an attorney, so I did not write this legislation. We have some incredible, truly like movement attorneys in our space, you know, and movement attorneys that were movement attorneys before they joined the space. They really are. I think sometimes we hear movement lawyers and it's a little bit of a buzzword, but these are folks who really do come from from labor organizing and are, you know, with folks on the ground on the daily. So folks who, yeah, created this really beautiful piece of legislation with the ideas that we all brought to the table of like, this is what we're looking for. How can we make this legal? So our policy working group really focus on really trying to do what we call right the inside game of, you know, assessing who our potential, who are our targets of within the city council, who our allies would be, and really making sure that also like within that space, it wasn't just led by the attorneys, like they were there to really support as needed, but really we were really supporting in the leadership and skills development of tenants, of impacted tenants who needed to be in these spaces, demanding from council members, engaging with council members. And also like, again, I don't wanna keep saying demystifying, right? But there are a lot of barriers for everyday people to engage with decision makers, with council members, really with just like politicians. And it can be really overwhelming on purpose, right? All of that is very, very intimidating. So really the process that we had around that was really like supporting tenants to really lead the conversation and not just to come into a space and just tell like their story and or how they were impacted, what we call trauma porn, right? Like that we are not trying to like exploit people to just share how they're struggling and that be the way they contribute. You know, these are folks who are consistently like learning how these processes work, which helps for people to really, again, build power and skill build and share this with their communities and also be able to come into these spaces with way more courage and understanding. So that was a lot of what our policy working group really focused on. Also, again, a lot of strategic planning of like assessing the housing landscape. Myself as a tenant organizer and being from an org at the time that was doing tenant organizing work, we consistently engage with the Housing Committee of DC Council. So it's just like, again, leveraging that knowledge and supporting tenants and building that. I too was a part of the action working group. So again, like Patrick said, a lot of action planning and pivoting and a lot of really, I mean, I love the word nitty gritty because that's what the work is, right? It's really not glamorous. It's a lot of just getting together, trying to plan this and trying to also make sure that this is in alignment with like, what are we trying to accomplish here? And how are we going to pressure our targets to get to where we need them to get to? And also action planning, right? Isn't just actions that will move target or put pressure on targets. It's also around community building. So, you know, that was also another part of our action planning, making sure that we are taking the time to be together, to be in community with each other and to build solidarity with one another. I want to be mindful of time. So, I mean, I could talk more about what this work looked like, but I'd love to hear some questions maybe on what folks want to hear. So I'll transition to really some of the innovative ways that we have addressed some of the challenges to the work. And really, we have existed during the pandemic only. So that was our starting point. And, you know, if you're familiar with community organizing, this is something that's really just happening outside in community, outdoors. And this, we came together in a time where, yes, we knew each other. We had been in community organizing spaces together, but we were all learning at the same time how to be in a virtual space and not in a virtual space that's like multilingual, different access to technology, different skills on technology. I know that was my, like when the pandemic started, Zoom was brand new to me and really just, you know, different levels of literacy and really like a lot of what I would call like the innovative voice we addressed that was really tackling that virtual space and making sure that we were creating a virtual space that could hold like that multilingual priority. Making sure that people were learning at the same time, we're building community with each other at the same time, that and could even just like log into these spaces, right? So we had to create a lot of, yeah, just videos and how to get on Zoom. And then also like, how are we going to be in this space together where we're like can be in community with each other, but also making sure that like we are hearing each other, right? And then having to deal with Zoom fatigue, all of the things that I know you are all familiar with as we have been in this pandemic, just doing that in a way that was really, really accessible and making sure also rooted. I am really proud of what we have. We are a bilingual space. It's Spanish and English predominantly, but even within tenant organizing, I have been in spaces where we are having a simultaneous like conversation in like 3-4 different languages. And you should have been there for like the first 20. They were brutal, but you know, we adapt, we learn. So I think that was a lot of just our innovation of like trying to figure out how to really move to virtual organizing. Also, I think one of the innovative ways we addressed some of the challenges in our work was, I know this is not new, but it was new for the pandemic, really how we, reached out to those council members, those targets. You know, at this point we are all, you know, on lockdown and really realizing like, well, we can't go to the, you know, where the building where the council members are because they're not in their offices. So I guess we're going to just go to their homes. And that's where we're going to go and have meetings with them and have actions. And again, it was not, we did not invent this, but we were like some of the first to really during the pandemic to do like an action on the same day at different council members' homes and just disrupted some of their meetings on purpose, right? So we could be like really engaged with them about what was needed. And they were not happy, of course, and that's part of the point. and really just within us, like really trying to figure out how do we really make five mini actions happen all at once successfully. And I will say it with a lot of trial and error, but I will pass it to Patrick to share about some of the other innovative ways we have addressed this work.
Yeah, one to come back to the virtual space. So it's funny, right? Because what we're doing right now, just talking at you is not how the camp, like it's very interactive. We're always trying to, you know, tease out content and inform our work from people's experiences. There's always music, there's always, we're always trying to recreate or adapt what we used to do in real life. To the extent that we could, we did popular education exercises. I had the capacity to do that a lot with members of 1DC.
Patrick, can you just share what popular education is?
Off the dime, yeah, I could try. Some of y'all might be familiar with Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. He's a person that popularized popular ed from his time working with Brazilian workers. And it's essentially trying to confer knowledge, typically of a political nature, right? And usually you're doing it with working class folks in a way that elicits, that engages all ways of learning, but primarily like experiential learning, doing learning. It's not passive information, right? It also like confers like skill building, right? Like, for example, like the Freedom Schools of the 60s in Alabama, right, which was, you know, helping folks build their literacy tests because for Black folks to vote, they had them read like, you know, parts of the Constitution, whereas for white folks, they had them read like the back of a milk carton or some shit. no lie. But so, you know, doing pop ed like that. So we do pop ed on like how to conduct a one-on-one or how to door knock, right? Door knocking can be very... and you know, can breed a lot of anxiety if you're not familiar. And sometimes people have a tendency to like either be apologetic or sound like they're, you know, they're Jehovah's Witnesses or something like that. And, you know, doing like that kind of training with folks, like, hey, we're not selling anything, right? Like you're knocking on this person's door because you're generally trying to share like, hey, so what's going on in your building? Like, you know, your neighbors are telling me X, Y, and Z, like, is this familiar to you? You know, when we were training, I was like, this is work that you lead with emotion, right? Like you can write any number of like white papers on this work, but at the end of the day, this work is relationships. And it's what drives you to do it is something personal and it's emotionally driven, right? And that's what you got to elicit out of people to do this kind of work, right? But so we would do this in a virtual space, which, you know, there's a lot of challenges to doing that. PopEd is difficult enough on its own when you're face to face, but another thing would be like these multi-locale actions that we did. I think what was particularly innovative is either for the first time or the first time in a very, very long time, you had a number of organizations coming together doing simultaneous actions. Like that doesn't happen. One thing that, you know, we usually keep it in-house, you know, don't want to air out dirty laundry, but a lot of our peers, we have a hard time working together for any number of reasons. We got, you know, a lot of them organizational, structural, whatever. And Council Rent DC was really kind of a unique creature, remains a unique creature. This was a good way to try to like garner media attention. We're trying to garner media attention during the pandemic. And this is a time when like folks really want to tamp down on that. So, you know, simultaneous banner drops, excursions at council members' homes. That was a pretty innovative tactic. Our COVID prep was also quite innovative. There's no way of sugarcoating it. This work is inherently dangerous. And some things just can't be done in a virtual space, like door knocking. As long as people are people, you're going to gain members the same old-fashioned way, and it's by showing up at the doorstep. So we had to come up with proper like COVID guidelines: wear gloves, 2 masks, don't let anyone take the thing. You know, we know what I'm saying. Okay, yeah, you know, let people use their own pens, or you write down their information for them. I know when we were coordinating some of these actions, you know, not everyone has transportation, so we'd have a number of volunteers who are willing to drive, and we'd have like, okay, no more than 3 people to a car, or if it's 4 people, everyone has their windows down. Sucks riding with your windows down in the winter, but everyone's got the windows down, double masking, everyone's got the sanitizer.
And Patrick, if I can add, I mean, this was right, like 2020, when we don't have a lot of guidelines. We don't have a lot of knowledge on how, like, we are truly figuring it out and are left to figure out, right? Like, to figure it out. And yeah, a lot, I would say, even within our space, like, we have been pretty COVID, like, safe and conscious throughout this entire time. And we haven't had a super spreader event. We haven't had an outreach event that led to folks getting sick. And I mean, again, not trying to put this personal, like, this onus on us, that like of personal responsibility, but I think we have to, like Patrick saying, name that, like, we took as many precautions as possible without really understanding what this landscape looked like. And this was pre-vaccines being accessible, right?
Yeah, so, you know, we did quite, you know, in retrospect, and while you're doing it, you don't realize how innovative you're being, right? So in retrospect, we have managed to do some pretty amazing work, with hopefully tons of amazing work yet to come. Again, Veronica and I could talk your ear off until 5 p.m., but it is Saturday at 2 p.m. over here. So we were wondering maybe we could move into, you know, recommendations on allyship and support for your work. I see one of the questions around here is, how can people become good allies to those doing this kind of work? And, you know, I'm going to take this on, and it's really funny because I talk to a lot of people, and people will want to support you in any and every way imaginable, except for coming to the meetings. And that's like number one is coming to the meetings. Just come to the meetings. And now almost all of them are virtual. So, you know, if you want to know how you can help, these are, you know, we're fighting these big nebulous things, right? White supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, da, 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 da. But the way they manifest are hyper-specific, right? And the only way you're going to help is if you come to these meetings and you listen to the folks who are impacted by this stuff, right? The answers are in the words and in the experiences that people share. They may not like spell out the answers, but within the soup is the content, right? So again, this is a, for example, like the difference between like, you know, a nonprofit advocacy lawyer and a movement lawyer, right? Movement lawyers have developed a frame of reference outside of the legal system. You know, they understand what the legal system can and cannot do, right? There are certain types of issues that tenant organizing can handle way quicker than the courts. And either you can go either way, but the courts is going to be long drawn out. Whereas tenant organizing, you just probably, you do some good organizing, yeah, rent strikes. And see what that does for your landlord. See if he don't, all of a sudden he's like, well, you know. Definitely, and that kind of nuance and understanding comes from just showing up to these places, right? So wherever you're at, go find, you know, like whatever the issues are, like go find an organization that is led by the people that are impacted by whatever issue is at hand. That's the first, you know, and then there's no like quick way of figuring out which is a good organization, which isn't. Get in where you fit in. It's really not rocket science, right? And then you figure out like, okay, well, also listening. In these spaces with the folks that we work with, a lot of our folks, you know, particularly like a lot of the older Black women that I worked with, a lot of them were, it was communicated to them either directly or indirectly that their voice didn't matter. So they come to meetings, some of them aren't ready to, like, you gotta elicit that stuff out of them, whereas other folks are, you know, all their lives they're told you can be whatever you want. So they come into this space and they genuinely wanna help, but they don't realize how much space they're taking. I'm saying this as I'm like gabbing away. it's coming with a spirit of like, I'm here to listen, but I'm here to listen with the intent to do, right? Because there are also folks that come to listen and then like by meeting 10, they're still here just listening. I'm like, who are you keeping that seat warm for? but beyond so, you know, come to the meetings and then try to leverage, come to the meeting, get to understand what it is folks are about and why they are about it the way they are. And then figure out, okay, what can I bring to the table? What can I leverage? Do I have a specialty here, right? Is it law? Is it research? Is it, are you a rabble rouser? Do you not mind getting in trouble with the police? But another way you can help is through resources. And I'm going to pass to Veronica to talk a little bit about what that means to leverage your resources.
Yeah, absolutely. And one quick note on popular education is that popular education is like everyone is a teacher and everyone is a student, right? We are all learning and teaching each other. And that is, we are not, you know, like Patrick said, we've been talking at you this whole time. That is not how we like move forward with it. We all have something to contribute and teach each other. And that is like pretty foundational. But back to resources. Yeah, I think one incredibly important and necessary recommendation on allyship and support of just our work is really leveraging your resources. And that looks like money, that looks like time, that looks like skills, that looks like power, right? When we are talking about organizing, this isn't this, we are not talking about conceptual things. We are talking about literal material wins for the people. And that looks like redistributing wealth. That looks like, again, there are attorneys, there are people who have a lot of different kinds of skill sets that can come to the space and support that. There are some doors other people can open. And instead of just using that for clout and saying, oh, well, I can get in that door, it's actually opening the door and saying, these are the folks that need to be in that space. I'm going to keep saying money, it like needs to happen. Our movements are so underfunded, and truly if our organizing movements can be as like detached from the nonprofit industrial complex and its funding sources, the better. So that means we have to rely on us as a community. And some of the most like radical and really incredible things I have seen, even within tenant organizing around tenants, like being able to become co-ops, is when community and wealthy like individuals were actually redistributed their wealth for this to happen in a way that didn't really involve the state. So yeah, I will keep saying that. But again, not everyone's coming to that place with like that type of like material resource. So again, like our skills, our time, our labor, the way we show up with each other, those are resources. And I think that our movements are not just about the fights and how the things that we are trying to win. It's also like literally in action, like creating the communities that we want, right? Like this isn't a future thing. This isn't an endpoint. This is like a never ending process of becoming. So we all have different things to contribute to these spaces to really, for us to thrive and find joy, right? Like we're doing this work, not just because we're trying to fight against something. It's because we're trying to build and because we love one another and we want everyone to eat, to be okay, to be housed and et cetera, right? So yeah, again, could say more, but I'll leave it there. And I think we have maybe one last thing around some of the commonly held assumptions among the general public, things that we need to challenge. And I'll just say like my part and just kick it to Patrick. But really, I think one of the like a really commonly held assumption within our, even within our spaces in the general public is that, right, we do live in the society. We have to grapple with that. There are things that we need to do. We need to move our targets. But really, you know, Angela Davis said this, you know, we cannot rely on governments, regardless of who is in power, to do the work that only mass movements can do. We have the power to really like get the things that we need. The community knows exactly what it needs to get their needs met. And I think that it's important to be strategic and target those in power, but understanding that like we are the ones that can create that. So it's, again, just more the assumption of like, we cannot put our trust on the government. We just need to be very strategic about how we engage. Anything for you, Patrick?
Yeah, definitely. I do want to jump in a little bit of what you said. Like, yeah, just think about any like good thing you have that's legally mandated, you know, like a 40-hour work week, which should be even shorter, or, you know, maternity leave, which we barely have any of it, or healthcare, like any of these things the government never gave you. Like people forced the government to give us. The government does not give. It is forced into giving. And will only continue to give if you force it to. That's something that we got to keep, you know. Even, you know, Bernie wasn't going to save me. Like, you got to force Bernie. He was just probably easier to, like, force, maybe. The other commonly held assumption, and I think this is particular in the United States, is, you know, when folks say, like, you're a radical leftist, radical POC, I think we're, like, starry-eyed and foaming at the mouth, right? Like, we don't understand how the world really works, like, you know, even speaking to my own, you know, parents, we're working in a coalition where we got folks at the street level, all the way to the most seasoned policy wonk, to legislative directors in, you know, local government, to Congress. We understand the process of change in a society made of laws, which has nothing to do necessarily with morality and all to do with codifying power. We get that this is really, you know, we fully understand, folks need to fully understand that this type of fight is really long and drawn out and messy. And while you're trying to create these new systems, you're existing in these former systems that are often at odds, which you have internalized yourself, and you will, you know, it's a continual process that's not a, you know, two steps forward, one step back, do a pirouette, and you know, it goes on and on and on and on. And the other one, which people hate this, but like it's sacrifice. For example, till the end of my days, I'll tell you that like DC was never going to let us cancel rent legally. It can't. The capital of the most capitalist country in the world will not let you do this, pull a socialist move purely legally, right? But that's not a problem because enough power turns the illegal into legal, right? It's never whether it's legal or illegal, it's do you have enough power to do it, right? So I'd say those are some commonly held assumptions that we definitely have to keep challenging. We have talked at you for a hot minute, and you know, we'd love to take some follow-up questions from from y'all. And thank you so much for giving us this the space to speak with y'all.
Yeah, I mean, thank you guys. That was, yeah, incredibly illuminating. Yeah, it's hard to know where to begin as well. I mean, part of what I think I certainly want to get across is that it's, you know, everything you're doing is does seem like really incredible and really successful. I mean, not that the kind of, you know, the validation you need for that work is from the communities you're working with, not some guy in London, but for what it's worth, some guy in London, yeah, very much approved. And kind of to, yeah, briefly abuse my position as moderator and chuck in a first question, I think it's kind of related to that. I think, like, you know, a lot of the problems that you talk about, obviously a lot of that ties back to the specific history of DC, but, you know, the kind of economic makeup of over here and in the States is broadly pretty similar, right? A lot of the same kind of issues facing tenants are pretty similar with, you know, slightly different histories, slightly different places and whatever. But what I'm not sure is, I don't know how well it kind of translates over to DC, but I know, you know, one of the issues with this kind of organizing in London, specifically with kind of mutual aid programs and stuff like that, is that everyone moves about so quickly in London. You know, frequently people aren't really in their flats for more than a year or two, whether it's because prices are going up or landlords want to sell on or evict or, you know, any number of reasons. And again, because of the kind of the size of London, these kind of communities sort of do shift about quite a lot. And obviously, you know, that's very specifically one of the things that you guys are trying to tackle, right? Like that's one of the reasons that people need to not get evicted, need to have that kind of rent relief. But what I'm wondering is how that kind of challenge is navigated in the organizing space, given that so much of it relies on or requires, you know, solid communities and that kind of trust that can only really come from, you know, someone who like knows your space, like knows where you've come up, knows the kind of even the barbershops to me and that kind of stuff, like that kind of community knowledge that you can't really fake and you can't really kind of get from a book or whatever, like that kind of stuff. How does that how would you kind of overcome that challenge, I guess, in the organizing space where it's kind of difficult to maintain those communities? You know, do you have quite a lot of people who've kind of blown into where you guys are that do manage to get in and get stuck in and kind of and develop that trust? And does it rely on having the kind of the coherence of that institution, whether it's those organizations that make up the coalition and stuff like that?
You know, again, speaking just knowing the context here in DC, I think that's where the longstanding comes into play, right? The nucleus or center or core of your organization or your organizing effort, you know, if you're doing it with a longstanding community, presumably those folks aren't going to go anywhere as long as they can, right? I have found that the folks that, and DC is a huge transient city as well, right? Folks come in and out, doing an internship, you know, trying to get a button on my resume, whatever, you know, and less cynical things. I'm just a cynical bastard. but, you know, those folks, you know, and mind you, you can come and do like really good work for like a year or two and then leave and then keep in communication. But it is about primarily trying to build relationships with the longstanding folks. Like, you know, London is what, 1,000-year-old city. you know, like what are the longstanding communities there that are facing unjust strife, right? I think the bigger challenge would be like building relationships with, if you're not part of that community, building relationships and gaining trust in order to tackle these things, right? And that, you know, that's the part you can't fake, right? You got to show investment. You got to just hang out. You got to just hang out, man. Come to the cookout. And, you know, if you have 5 to 10 core people, you know, that base in my experience can hold a lot. And, you know, like the leaves may, you know, the leaves come and go, but the branches stay, you know? Veronica, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I really appreciate that question, Danny, because that's super real and it sucks, right? I think that's something that we like also experience here, right? Like Patrick said, and I'm you know, as you were, you know, framing your question, I started thinking of like so many of like the tenants who were literally displaced from DC and had to like leave and can, and, you know, some, you know, we would like, through our cancel rent funds, like when we were having actions or certain things, we were making sure like, hey, let's get you a train. Let's get you like, let's get you here so we can be in community together. So I think like, Patrick, right. Like even thinking of Grace, when we had the banner drops, who designed the banners and was in New York, and it was like getting her into the space. And that was so important. So I think that in recognizing that, as unfortunate as it is that we can't maybe be in everyday space together, I think this reimagining we've been able to do around the virtual world, one, allows us to be in community a little bit more broadly, right? There's a lot of us here in different time zones. I think also being really, really intentional about planning certain things where we can be together, and then making sure we can use resources to get the folks who are like, again, no longer in that like vicinity to that space. Also recognizing that it's not perfect and that, yeah, we do end up losing a lot of people, but I think that's why like movements are so much larger than just a few people. They're really about making sure that like this work continues and that people, if needed or wanted, can leave and come back as, you know, as possible. But it is a real challenge. And I think that just really speaks to like the larger cycle of like displacement. You know, yes, some people might be just coming here to get that check on that box, but some people can't afford to be in the cities, right? Or there are so many circumstances. And I think even just the way global society, the way like we even like function now around like community, it's we are consistently moving in ways that like wasn't necessarily what was happening before, right? We were more rooted. So I think really, really making sure that we're not just having our movements being about our fights, but also about how we're building together. So there's a little bit of an anchor to come back to. And like, that is something that right now, you know, in cancel rent, we are facing, you know, as we're trying to figure out what we're doing next. A few folks have stepped back momentarily, and a few of us like have leaned into like hold that space to make sure it continues and breathe a little like fire and life into it, you know? And I think the root of that is like valuing also like our community members and making sure that we can have accessible ways to engage with each other.
Nice. Yeah. That's, yeah. Instructive and yeah, good to hear. I could pose a million more questions as well, but I'm conscious that we're it's relatively short on time, and I don't want to also monopolize any space. I know Tyler's just dropped something in the chat as well. I don't know if Nisha, if you wanted to take the lead going through that and any other remaining questions, but yeah, just to say again, thank you for that answer. That's, yeah, interesting to hear.
Thank you, Patrick and Veronica. That was great, guys. Just has one question. He is asking, curious of what is the demographic of residents that move into those residences where tenants are forcibly displaced? And have you ever tried to engage them in any way to contribute to your movement?
You want to go first this time? No, you don't.
I'm a processor. I need a minute to like read through the question and think through. So also we can let it be silent for a second if needed, Patrick.
I rely on my masculine conditioning. I got to give an answer right away. Seem competent, even if it's the wrong answer. So Tyler, I think there's many ways of answering this question. And I think it's also dependent on, you know, there's the broader movement philosophy, and then there's individual organizational philosophies. And I know in my particular organization, right, which was a Black liberation organization, we have found that allies will show up, right? You don't have to come looking for them, right? Like, for example, Georgetown, UDC, a number of places of higher learning, and a number of of you know, nonprofits know about my former organization, and you know, quote, those folks will come, right? And we have found that the kind of work that eventually needs to get done, right? There's a lot of like learning and exciting stuff, but at some point in time when you're doing the campaign work, you'll go from like green actions where you might be, you know, petitions, knocking on people's doors, blah, 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 to more confrontational actions, which are like yellow actions, blocking off roads, blah, blah, blah. When you get to the red actions, we have found that it's very rare that the people who will put their safety, their body, their livelihood on the line, it's very rare that those people are not the people who stand to gain or lose the most from it. So that's who we primarily want to build trust and power with, because that's the people that's going to need support. And that's also the only people that are really going to lead that thing. And again, what we see a lot is, you know, our allies tend to have to go through, some of them kind of have to go through like a learning process of like, again, like managing taking space or like knowing when to, you know, sometimes it's like opposite things. Sometimes they're like, there's like a crippling guilt there, which is not helpful. Like no amount of guilt is going to keep me from getting shot by the cops, you know? But just to put it bluntly, but you know, we find that like, you know, our allies tended to show up, and the times when we, you know, for example, we went door knocking in Anacostia, and which is a, you know, predominantly a historical Black neighborhood, but then, you know, new folks are starting to pop up. Whenever we knock on those doors, tell them what we're doing, a lot of times it was like, oh, that sounds really interesting. Oh yeah, yeah, no, I'll take a thing. Yeah, this is great. Yeah, maybe I will. And that's where that tended to end, right? So, you know, I think I'll, you know, there's more I could say, there's more avenues I could go, but I'll stop there for the moment, and I'll pass it over to Veronica. Maybe if you want to answer like the demographic information, I mean, our Black residents have gone down to 41% from 70%, you know, but I'll pass it over to you.
Yeah, I really appreciate this question, Tyler. And I think I can actually speak to it more as a tenant organizer who was doing a lot of like on the ground work and buildings all over DC. I think that the demographic of residents, right, is that move into residences where folks are displaced. Also, just for the record, I was mostly working in like rent controlled buildings. It's younger and wider for sure, but I think, it really has depended. And I think we just need to be really transparent about like, yeah, Chocolate City is not chocolate. It's not called Chocolate City anymore, right? For a reason. And there it's because of that displacement of like Black DC residents. And I have tried to engage with folks in ways to contribute to movement, you know, at a building level. It really requires the collective and the majority to really like build power and move forward with rent strikes or move forward with addressing conditions issues in different ways, or when a building is for sale, which triggers this very particular law in DC, it requires like a majority. So like, yes, there has always been an attempt to engage. And I think, again, the responses vary, but within the context of Cancel Rent DC, I think to be pretty frank, we are 2 years old, going on our third year, came together during the pandemic, while all of us went from doing the work that we were doing and then having to like do that like 10 times more. I don't know. It was just like, honestly, like the uptick was so intense and so quick that we were like, this is who we are building with. These are the folks at the table. And I think as someone who hasn't been part of the outreach working group, I'm not sure like what the approach has been around trying to engage allies. There have been allies in this space, but I am happy and proud to say that like a lot of the folks that are in this space are like tenants with like a personal buy-in who are like impacted in one way or another. And, but there is room for allies, and there is room for folks who, you know, at this point, I am no longer part of an organization, and I am part of Cancel Rent, and I am a tenant, but I am not an impacted tenant. And here I am like trying to support in ways I can while also stepping back and knowing my lane. Right. So yeah, I think that there's definitely a way for folks to be in that space. And we, that's not who we are centralizing, but that is definitely something that we value. You know, this work requires all of us in different ways.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, there's a couple more questions popping up. I'm very aware that we've taken like half an hour more of your time than we agreed to. So it's, yeah, up to you. I mean, I think we can wrap up if you want to, if you need to go off, we can, you know, we can keep this conversation going on email or something like that as well. But I just, yeah, wanted to again reiterate that, like, yeah, it's been, yeah, absolutely wonderful having you guys here. I've certainly learned a lot. I hope that everyone else has as well. And yeah, like, thank you everyone else who's come to join as well, and everyone in the future who's listening to it, hopefully. I mean, maybe rent has been cancelled by the time they're all listening to it, and then this becomes useless, but I imagine that might not be the case. So yeah, thanks again to everyone, and thanks especially to Patrick and Veronica. We're certainly gonna stay in touch in one way or another and pick your brains more when you're willing to let us, and hopefully we can kind of help you guys out more going forwards. Just to remind everyone again, we have got the fundraiser. I'll put the link in here, and we're going to email that out to everyone as well. So hopefully that also does something to help the cause. But other than that, I don't know if anyone's had any kind of final words to drop in at the end. Yeah, Veronica, what's that?
Can I add something, just because I did see the two questions in the chat? And I mean, those are very juicy, meaty questions that require a much longer conversation. But I think if maybe we could just do a quick like thing on it, and then we can wrap up. I'm willing to do that.
Please do.
Yeah, I think I can take Lana's question if that's cool. And Patrick, maybe you can take the other one, because I know this is something that you were focusing on around housing, around rent. Did you see that question? Yeah. Does that sound good to you?
That's right. Let me take the more nebulous one.
I mean, you're working on the right to housing campaign.
Yeah, it's cool if I jump in. Yeah, you know, if housing is a human right, then does rent make any sense at all? I think my most honest answer to that to you is I don't know. I know that housing is a human right, should be a human right. Let's start there. Is there ever a scenario where rent makes sense? That's a far broader discussion. But what I do know is that you go talk to any number of economists and they will tell you that having people housed, having every individual housed that is without a home, including little babies, which of course will never live by themselves, but even having them having their own individual homes would be less costly on society in terms of money, in terms of healthcare costs, in terms of mental healthcare costs, in terms of all types of costs would be less costly than keeping folks the way they are now. There are a number of examples of socialized housing out in the world that works, from places to Germany to, you know, in Nicaragua to who are the homies in Mexico? I don't know why I keep forgetting their name.
Los Zapatistas.
Yes, the Zapatistas. Like there's a whole bunch of different, also including like various African models. There are models of socialized housing that can be blown up and you know, modulated for the American context, right? What is important is, you know, what is the narrative? Where is the narrative coming from? Who is it benefiting, right? Believe impacted people, right? There's a huge thing, in the States and around the world is like folks have a hard time believing impacted people, right? Like, you know, and if you can't just like straight up, you know, and I wouldn't tell you to just take it just on face value, like go talk to them, like, why are they saying what they're saying? What is it rooted in, right? And you'll see the trail, right? It's all out there, right? It's it, all this stuff that we're talking about is well documented in the United States. It's not like in some hidden book somewhere in some radical library. It's well documented. It's just not made publicly available, you know, in a media context. So go find the folks and learn why they say what they say, and then and just know that this change, right, is people power. You will need to force the governments to change, right, at all levels. You know, in urban planning is like, you know, real estate is the thing, right? They're not making more land, right? So, you know, that's like one of the greatest battles, I'd say. And as for, you know, is there, you know, does rent ever make sense? You know, I feel that if we could just get everyone in a home first, that in and of itself is such a long, arduous battle that by the time you get to that point, maybe that question disappears altogether, you know?
Thanks, Patrick. Really appreciate that. And I think that, you know, how do we move toward personal community housing rent abolition or just abolition in general? It's by a lot of different approaches, right? It's like, we know that what we are living in right now doesn't work. We need to try different things. And I think this comes up and also, right, like police abolition, the prison industrial complex. It's like, what will we do? It's like, well, this isn't working. Let's figure it out. But we do not have to have all the answers at this very moment. I will skip to, or moving to the next question. I really appreciated this of, you know, how now that governments are pushing the narrative that the pandemic is over, which is happening everywhere, how do we maintain that momentum that COVID kicked off and continue to engage people in a transformative moment when they are fed up and ready to return to the status quo? I love this question because it also is really applicable everywhere. This is happening too within like police abolition, within the defund movement space, right? Like that there's this narrative now coming from elected officials from the police that there's this uptick in crime, quote unquote, in that it's because of those defund folks, because look at all the defunding we did, which actually we didn't. Like there was no jurisdiction that defunded, like that actually like lowered, or like that every police department has increased their budget. So like, what are we talking about? There was no defunding that happened. So I think something that we are all rooting in, whether it's in like defund spaces or housing spaces, is that we cannot just go off of these narratives that the government, elected officials, et cetera, et al, right? Everyone is putting out there because that's quicksand. You know, those narratives are consistently shifting, and those narratives were happening, those were being pushed even before the pandemic. And I think when we focus on like this big, loud, visible thing as the only way to really mobilize folks, we are going to get a lot of people who react, and again, well-meaning, but are very reactionary, who are going to burn themselves out in the first 2 years or less because they're just going all like going completely in. And then they're going to leave, want to return to the status quo. And like you said, just kind of like rinse and repeat. Something that we talk about a lot, have been talking a lot about cancel rent, is that we cannot go at the speed of capitalism. We cannot go at the speed of these legislative sessions. We really need to like step back and root and like take our time building movements the way a lot of folks in the global South do. These things take time. And I think that when we can really step back and not go at their speed, is how we really continue doing this work, and we can engage people in a meaningful way instead of focusing on like this specific moment in time, like our legislation, right? This is what we needed to push now, but just because we couldn't push that forward and quote unquote win, doesn't mean that we're stopping here. We're really gonna build together. We're gonna keep moving forward, and we're going to engage people in meaningful ways that are looking at this long-term vision, because the work is always happening. The work is always there. It's not always visible, but the only reason we're able to even do the things we do now is because of all the building that happened before. So something we're talking about a lot now in Cancel Rent is, let's stay together, keep building with each other, because there's going to be another really loud catastrophic moment, unfortunately, hate to say it, but we know it's happening. And when that happens, we are going to be even more prepared than we were before. And yes, we're going to get a lot of reactionary folks who want to join the space, but we will have, like at this point, have spent all this time building together, and we're going to be able to push things forward. So I think it's really stepping back and having that long-term vision instead of moving forward with narratives that the government's putting out there that are consistently shifting. Like, that's not what we have to create our own narratives and root with each other. And what I'll also recommend, just because, you know, this isn't a unique thing. This is happening everywhere. Like, I am not saying things that just came out of my brain. These are teachings that are coming from people who have been doing this for a lot longer than I've been alive, people who are still alive, people who are no longer here. And, you know, I am finding a lot of rooting in Miriam Kaba, Adrienne Marie Brown, and they talk about this. They talk about how we root and how we organize with people and how we also build with hope, with joy, with love, because those are the things that really keep us doing this work for a long time. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Yeah, that's pretty wonderful to hear. And I hope that that does answer more questions. I feel like I could listen to more for hours and hours as well. One thing that also made me think of is, like, I think when we'd spoken before, I think Patrick had mentioned that there are, like, other chapters of Cancer Rent as well, or not like directly linked necessarily, but and then, you know, referencing the kind of global south movements, that kind of, you know, intra and international solidarity is another way of kind of overcoming the fact that, you know, we're sort of small compared to the powers that be, but, you know, if we can link up across time and through borders, then, you know, we've got a fighting chance. But yeah, if there's nothing else, to no other questions to add, you know, if, again, I know you guys have days to go off and finish. But I just wanted to, thank you again. I don't know if you've got any final words to add, or if not, if, you know, I think where we've left it is, got a lot to chew on, and I've certainly got lots of scribble pages to now try and decipher as well. So I guess just remain to say thank you again, especially Patrick and Veronica. Everyone else that's come to listen, you know, the rest of the founding members, everyone who's helped to kind of this whole event together. It's our first birthday, hopefully the first of several, and hopefully the kind of first event of several as well. I mean, it's kind of onwards and upwards from here. And again, just one more final call out to the fundraiser that is going to be spammed around as we share the video as well, and hopefully get as many eyes and open wallets and purses as we can. Thank you. I don't know if Sarah, you had any final words as well to kind of finally wrap things up as our founder and esteemed leader.
Thank you, Danny. I mean, other than just a huge, warm and heartfelt thank you to Veronica and Patrick, and also it was very difficult not to dominate the question period. Because I have a lot of questions, but I held back and I'm very proud of myself. So please let this be the beginning of a relationship. As Patrick and Veronica mentioned, this is all about relationship building. This is just the beginning. I will ask those questions at a later date. We'll keep the relationship strong and find other ways to continue to find contributors to the fundraiser, but other ways of supporting, whatever that looks like. And we'll keep learning from you as well. Don't forget to, just visit the fundraising page, do what you can. Any amount is welcome. And if you have any troubles with it, feel free to message us at collaboration@collaborativesocialchange.org. We'll walk you through the process. And yeah, I just look forward to more. Thank you for staying with us for, 43 minutes more than you should have. So please enjoy your Saturdays, and thank you, everyone. I'm really looking forward to keeping the conversation going.
Thank you so much, y'all, for having us. And I hope you all have an amazing Saturday.
Yes.
Thank you both so much. Enjoy your days. We'll see you soon.
Bye.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
stop recording.